what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Oh. Hello and welcome to The Great 80s, the great 80s movie debate, where we see if the movies of the 1980s still hold up today. If you're a child of the 80s, a fan of classic films, or just a movie geek, you've come to the right place. Today we are discussing 1988's Rain Man, starring Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman, directed by Barry Levinson. My name is Dave, and I am joined by an illustrious panel of 80s experts, including Christy.
Definitely a movie. Movie, definitely.
And Dave.
246 toothpicks.
Well, on this show, we like to go through the hosts and recollect our history with the movie that we're discussing so everyone knows where everyone is coming from. So, Christy,
yes.
What is your history with Rain Man?
Hold your seatbelts, gentlemen, because this is a movie I saw in a theater.
What?
You did?
Yes.
Probably because your family wanted to see it.
My father wanted to see it, and he just, I think it was shortly after it won the Academy Award, or it had been, it couldn't have, because it wouldn't have still been in theaters. It was buzzed about, and my father really wanted to go see it, and he liked Dustin Hoffman a lot, so we went to see it in the theater. That is all I remember about it, other than my dad really liked it.
Right. Is that the kind of movie your dad... It had to be something special or respected for your dad to actually go to the theater and see it? Was that the deal?
Yeah, because it was kind of like the first line of entertainment in my house was going to the video store, the one video store, and getting something on videotape, or... If we were getting the house fumigated or needed to leave the house for some reason, we would go to the drive-in. We saw a lot of movies in the drive-in. And then, you know, if we wanted... I think it's because my dad didn't like to sit for long periods of time. But we went to see E.T. and this movie. Those are the ones I really, truly remember. And, of course, I made him go to every Muppet movie with me. If my mom wasn't going. So we saw the you know, timeline and method of which I watched a movie varied, but mainly it was in the comfort of your own home.
Right.
Or at the drive-in.
All right. Well, what about you, Dave?
Well, so, I mean, clearly this was one of the big buzz movies of that year. Everyone was talking about it. I think it was the sort of introduction of the sort of autistic idea to a lot of people. Not many people knew about it. I didn't see it in the theaters. You know, I'm sure I saw it on home video or cable or something. And here, the thing is, one of my mom's brothers had Down syndrome, and he was a very low functioning. You know, he lived at home and or at a facility for his entire life, essentially. And so, even though I hadn't heard of autism, I was familiar with this idea where that he was very low functioning as far as, you know, communication and social skills, but he had this thing about radios and batteries. So I just remember every Christmas, you know, everyone would get him like batteries to use in his radios, because he would just love to sit and rock out to a radio. And no matter how much you hid the batteries in whatever packaging and wrapping you did, he would find them instantaneously. So there was this thing about, you know, having a low functioning in many ways, but high functioning in certain other ways, that I was sort of familiar with by the time this movie came out. And so the idea of autistic and, you know, a savant, even though I hadn't heard the terms before and I didn't really know anybody like that, I sort of knew somebody a little bit like that. And so that was kind of interesting and kind of hit home for me.
That is interesting. Well, and I did not see this in theaters either. This was not the kind of movie that I was really watching when I was, you know, 15 or 16, but I did see it probably 1989 on cable. And I know for a while what I did was I would pick an actor and I would go through their entire filmography to that point and see everything that they did. And this fit into that Tom Cruise time of me doing that. And like you said, this was a big deal. This won 4 Oscars. This was Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director, Best Screenplay. This was a huge deal. And I feel like everybody kind of saw this. And I didn't know at the time when I did was watching this movie that it would end up being what I do for a living, which is is strange now because I work in autistic support now. And it's funny that, you know, I mean, I didn't know that when I was little. And like you said, this was a big deal because it was the first time that a lot of people heard about this disability. And we'll talk about that as the movie goes on. But I love this intro and I feel like I've seen this movie a lot. And I was watching it today with my son and it's the kind of movie where it'll come on and you'll catch 3/4 of it. You don't watch it from the beginning. And I forgot the whole intro with the Bell Stars, Iko song and him inspecting all these cars he's getting. It's excellent. And it sets up his character. It sets up Charlie and the kind of businessman and guy that he is. He's a bully and a swindler, and he gets what he wants. He's an asshole.
He's not a very likable person at all.
No, he's a terrible person.
He's a terrible person.
I haven't seen this movie since probably the late 80s, and man, I forgot how much of a dick he was.
Oh, yeah.
And now, in retrospect, knowing... You know, hearing all the stories about Tom Cruise and everything, you're kind of like, wow, I wonder if he didn't have to work too hard for that.
Yeah, it's hard. He's one of those guys that is hard to, for some people, to break away his real life and his roles.
Yeah.
Sometime. And I don't think a lot of people understand a lot about Scientology. Like what the Church of Scientology stance was on a disability like this. And there is no official stance
from
the Church of Scientology, but anyone that's involved in Scientology, like Leah Remini has the show and it's a whole big thing.
Yep.
They said that they believe that anyone that has a disability like this is because they've come in contact with a suppressive person.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that ever came up on the set or any of that thing. Like it's not something that's in the trivia on IMDb.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But
when you watch a movie like this, I found myself thinking about it while I was watching it. I don't know. Did you?
Yeah. Like I agree. Like I'm not a big fan of Scientology and all that kind of stuff. And I kind of have to compartmentalize that when I watch a Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah.
But I didn't think about it because I enjoyed watching this movie so much today. Didn't come up at all. Whereas when I watched freaking Battlefield Earth a couple of weeks ago for my other podcast, like that's all I could think about was what does this guy think he is? You know?
Yeah.
And getting to Tom Cruise's personal life. Now, granted, you know, the Scientology thing aside, whoever thinks of that, all I've ever heard from anybody who's ever encountered Tom Cruise is that he's the nicest guy around. Mm-hmm. He will help you and do whatever he can for you. I've never heard anything else. So like, I it's really hard to know what to think about him, right?
It is. It's so shrouded in mystery. And I really do love watching documentaries about Scientology and they'll bring up their use of celebrities in it. And it's always about him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he is the almost like the poster child for it. He's like the highest level.
I mean, he's like Xenu's right hand man at this point, right?
Yeah.
Right hand tentacle.
No, that's Thulu. Cthulhu. I don't know.
Bless you. But in the movie, he and Susanna, who is Valeria Golino, they're about to go on vacation when they find out the news that his father has died and the funeral's the next day in Cincinnati. This sets up the rest of the movie. There's a lot of foreshadowing in the beginning because there's this background about his dad and they see the car and it's this 1940-something Buick Roadmaster. And the car is very symbolic. And he tells the story about how he spent 2 days in jail when he tried to borrow it because his dad wouldn't let him drive it. And he tells the first story about the Rain Man.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just sort of an offhand thing. It's like whenever I would get sad, the Rain Man would sing to me or help me or whatever it was.
Exactly.
And he thinks of them, of Rain Man, as his, you know, childhood imaginary friend.
Yep.
Yeah. It's wonderful writing, and you can see why it won the Oscar, because not only does it come back later, it's really kind of like the linchpin in him changing a lot. It doesn't have anything to do with that part of it. But then when they are on the road later, like, Raymond won't go out in the rain. There's little things that they set up all along the way, even right there when he's getting the will and how he gets the car and rose bushes, and Raymond gets $3 million. He doesn't know it's Raymond yet. But he goes on this tirade about the rose bushes. He's like, I got the rose bushes. I definitely got the rose bushes. He talks exactly like Raymond's going to talk later.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's a good point.
They have the same kind of speech patterns at times. There are times when Cruz is getting manic that he sounds a lot like Hoffman when he's getting manic. It's really, really great.
Yeah.
And because he gets what he wants, he sweet talks his way into knowing that the trustee and the funds are belong to a person at a hospital, Walbreck or Walbeck or something like that, where he meets his unknown brother. And it is a great meeting. They call him an autistic savant. And these aren't words you hear anymore.
No.
No, and even then they mentioned the previous term, which was idiot savant.
Exactly.
They kind of mentioned that in passing, which yeah. I had heard that was a term that was kind of used in the 80s as well. But yeah.
Yeah, the way it is in working in the field that I work in, terminology changes a lot, and the way everything is said, it becomes like the most important thing. Sometimes, in my opinion, too important. In fact, when I go to in services and I go to meetings for my job, you're not supposed to say that person is autistic. You're supposed to say that is a person with autism.
Right.
Yeah.
Because now you're labeling that person, and that's all they are. They're just autistic. Well, they're just a person with autism. So the doctor's explanation in this actually isn't that bad. And I'm not going to get on a soapbox about autism because it is what I do for a living. Some of the things they say are accurate as far as abilities and things like that. Some of the things are inaccurate as far as stereotypes. Mm-hmm. But it is whatever you want to say about it now in 2019, it is the thing that probably brought awareness to a lot of people that it was a disability and it was a thing that people were living with. So whether that's good or bad, it did that.
Yeah, right. And that's the thing is that it without this movie, how long would it have been before autism had the public, you know, knowledge or awareness that it does?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I remember working like 24 years ago in a school in Maryland when I lived there. And one of the students in the school was really the first student I remember having been diagnosed with this. And the way people used to describe it is, you know, like in Rain Man.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like in the industry, it was used as, you know, the guy in Rain Man, that's him. Wow. Well, it wasn't. And things are, not like as they seem in the movies, obviously, but that's the way it, like you said, that's the way it was for like a long time.
And even by the late 90s and early 2000s, when I moved out to California, Silicon Valley, to work in the tech industry, you know, there's a lot of people who are computer science, computer engineers who are socially awkward. And it became very common just to say, oh, they're on the spectrum a little bit or this and that. And so that just became mainstream. It's like, oh, you can be on the spectrum and earn six figures, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the people that you'll meet with autism can do things, like I've met people that can do things that I'll never, ever be able to do. And Raymond is an example of that in the movie. Some of that stuff that he can do is for real. I've met people.
What do you think is like not realistic that he can do in the movie?
It's more about, I think, his behaviors and not the abilities, okay, but the way, I think it's more the way that Hoffman plays him. And I did some research on Hoffman, and he did do his research and he spent some time with a lot of people. But I think that most people, because even in the movie, they say, oh, he's a rare case because he's highly functioning. Most autistics, they can't even speak. Well, I guess that's true to some degree, but that isn't what I would say most cases are. I think people with autism are more high functioning than they are not. And some of his behaviors are a little over the top because mm-hmm. it's a movie.
Okay.
Some of those things definitely do happen as far as like self-harm and being ritualistic and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. It just takes it to an extreme because it's a movie. I think that for a long time, people thought everybody with autism was like that. And I've met hundreds and hundreds of people with it. And I'd say a very small percentage of them behave like he does in the movie.
Okay.
That's all. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when you have like 2 hours to address a story, I don't think you have time for nuance.
Right.
You kind of have to, you have your hour and a half, your 2 hours to portray this story and get it from A to B.
Yeah.
As much as he probably, especially with an attention to detail and everything, there are going to be things that are not going to be as realistic. But at least it was an introduction for people who didn't have that exposure or didn't know or had people in their lives that they didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. That's a perfect way to put it. And I love his room. When they show his room with all the baseball stuff.
I bet you do.
Of course you would.
That room is so cool. And I remember I tried to find this and I can't find it because Saturday Night Live, they have all of their stuff under lock and key. Like you can't find stuff on YouTube. You have to like, I don't know. I think there's an app with Saturday Night Live sketches or something. It was so good. But it was a sketch where Dana Carvey played Raymond. And Phil Hartman played Pete Rose. It was during the Pete Rose betting scandal.
Oh.
And it was Pete Rose trying to get, you know, like betting tips from Raymond because he knows all the stats about baseball. It was so funny. And I want to find that so badly. And you start getting all of the things that people remember about this movie. His almost catchphrases like driving in the driveway on Saturday and Wapner and Jeopardy. Like they all start about now. And
That's the thing that like as soon as this movie came out, all those catchphrases entered everybody's consciousness like instantaneously.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I thought a lot of my mom used to watch People's Court religiously and I was like, oh mom, it's you. Had to watch Wapner. Had to watch it.
How often are these shows on that he's watching? Like he's watching Wheel of Fortune or Jeopardy at all hours of the day.
Yeah, it seems to be on except.
I don't know where Dave and I grew up. Jeopardy was on at 7 o'clock at night, and that's it. Well, there used to be a daytime Jeopardy, wasn't there?
Oh, I don't remember daytime.
I don't remember that.
Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune were on back-to-back at around 7, 6:30, whatever it was.
Still are.
Wapner was daily as well on weekdays.
They seem like they're constantly on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's sort of like Star Wars. You know, time is whatever it needs to be for the story.
Yeah.
And Charlie's plan is to kidnap Raymond, really hold him for ransom to get... Oh. Half of the money that he believes he's owed. He wants $1.5 million. He doesn't want to be greedy. He just wants his half. He's
just like Mel Gibson in Payback.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the score really starts kicking up about now. And I love this score. It was Hans Zimmer's first score.
Oh, was it his first?
Yeah. Oh. And that pan flute with the synthesizer. Yep. And I read online that Barry Levinson said he didn't want a lot of strings in it because he didn't want it to be sentimental and gooey. He wanted it to be a little grittier. So he went with the pan flute and man, did it work. I love this score.
It made me think a lot of Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like it felt like Karate Kid a little bit too.
Yeah.
It's so good. Do you feel like, and then the road trip starts. It is very funny at times. We used to laughing. I know I laughed out loud about how he's like, he didn't have his books and he's going to be bookless. And the sex scene, the comedy, is the comedy still working for you in this where you're laughing when you watched it?
I think so. It's not dated. I mean, it's kind of like universal things that would be funny situational. And you're not laughing at him. You're laughing at the situation.
Right. Absolutely. Especially that sex scene when he starts moaning in mimicking of her, like that cracked me up. And then he kind of walks in, sees them, and just sits down and turns around and watches television while they finish. It was, that cracked me up. And that might've been the first time. Cause the first part of everything up leading up to that, I was like, oh my God, Charlie's such a dick. And what is with these fashions and yada, yada, yada. And then we get there and I'm like, oh, this is a really good movie.
I think the best part of it is that if it stayed too heavy too long, it would be like almost too intense. In real life, you know, even in situations, you're still going to find humor. Even when you are dealing with somebody who has autism, there's still humor somewhere. I was listening to a TED Talk, and there was a family talking about, you know, a situation. And even though there are like highly emotional just moments where it's just intense, they would still have these stories about how, you know, this happened. And it wasn't funny then, but now it's kind of funny that right. They would laugh. And they were like, if you don't laugh, you'd cry.
Yeah, you got to find your moments.
So it was nice because it allowed that realistic break in the tension.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You brought up the fashions, Dave, and I hadn't even really considered it. My son was watching it. He was very, very upset that Tom Cruise buttons his button all the way to the top button.
I wrote that down. That always bugs me. If you're not going to wear a tie, you don't button the top
button. Nope.
I never noticed it. He noticed it and you noticed it. That was like a thing, right?
Every scene, both him and Raymond had their top, whether it was a polo shirt or a button down, they had their top button buttoned and never wore a tie until like at the very end, one of them had a tie on. But I'm like, seriously, who's doing the wardrobe on this show?
I think they started that trend.
I mean, I don't want to sound rude or insensitive or offensive, but whenever anyone buttoned the top button on a shirt like that,
I think that is kind of like a stereotype, especially in Hollywood and on TV. Like, look at Forrest Gump.
Exactly.
Top button. It's kind of like a trope that Hollywood has for, okay, this person has some challenges that, you know.
But then there was the startup that I worked at where the guy who founded it, who was a brilliant computer scientist, who knows how much on the spectrum he was, always buttoned a top button. But man, he ran a company. He ran several successful startups and was rich as fuck.
I just took it as that was a fashion because, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but Charlie has it buttoned.
And right. That's the thing. And maybe that's another one of these like, oh, this is how similar they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I hadn't even considered the fact that they would wear their clothes the same way.
Yeah. Well, they don't wear the same underwear, so.
No.
Well, yeah.
We learn everything about their
draw
underwear.
The line there.
But Susanna, at that point, after the sex scene leaves, at that point, she is our hero in the movie. She's going to disappear for a while, but she's the audience.
Yeah.
She's like the voice of reason in this shitstorm that Charlie has created.
Yeah.
And then after that is the diner scene, which includes the film debut of Bonnie Hunt.
Yay, Bonnie Hunt.
Who is freaking awesome. Who they would later be, well, I guess she's his sister-in-law, right? And Jerry Maguire?
Oh, really? Oh, that's funny. So, bringing up Jerry Maguire, like I thought of Jerry Maguire when I was watching this because it's the same sort of plot.
Right? Where he starts as an asshole and transforms.
Well, he's an asshole and transforms, but he's desperate for money. And the only person who he's you know, clinging onto for money is like slowing him down from getting money in other ways.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right. And so it just felt like that same dynamic with, you know, Jerry Maguire and what's his name?
Cuba Gooding.
Cuba. Yes.
Show me the money. You know, just,
exactly. So he's like, I need to make money in other ways or whatever, but you're not letting me. And that's sort of the same dynamic I felt for a little bit in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I never even thought about that. That's a good analysis. It would have been funny if while he was on the phone to the doctor, he actually said, show me the money.
Doc Bruce only ever played like three characters in his entire career. So
yeah.
ask Matt, he's every movie is the same.
Yeah, you're not far off. We're going to talk about Tom Cruise more later.
Yeah.
Yep.
But this is where Charlie discovers some of his abilities. He knows the phone numbers because he told him to read the phone book. He can do things that people can't do without the disability. I know a person that can tell you what day of the week any day in history was.
Wow.
Nice.
If you tell him that your birthday is July 19th in the year, he'll say that was a Thursday. That quickly.
Wow.
Has the calendar memorized throughout human history. And that kind of stuff is an ability. It's not a disability in some ways. And the toothpicks is the thing that really starts to get him to notice.
Yeah.
The 246 of them are on the floor. And I don't know if it's then or if it's later. When do you think he comes up with a plan to take him to Vegas? When he sees the sock in the dryer? Is that what it is? I know that this is maybe they're building to it, but it's when they're sitting in the thing and he says the red one always falls the same. Like it's like he's counting cards, but he's counting, you know, laundry.
I remember watching the scene and going, oh, that's where he gets the idea, but I can't remember what that scene was. Because right. I remember they drive through Vegas and they're somewhere on the other side.
Yeah, and then
he gets the idea and they turn around.
Okay. And he throws the cards on the hood and all that kind of stuff. Okay.
Well, it might have been the toothpicks, yeah.
The toothpicks. At least it was the first of a couple of clues that this is the way he can get his money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, because along this whole time, he keeps calling people on a payphone, and his business is slowly or quickly
falling apart.
Yeah. And his idea then is to fly, and that airport scene is, I love that scene. It's tough to watch, but it's good. In fact, I told myself when we were watching that airport scene, I have been to In Services, and it's used in Services. And as you sit there as a professional, you're watching this movie and you're supposed to analyze both Charlie and Raymond's behavior and some of the warning signs that would lead up to the outburst that he ends up having.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this is even used still to this day in things that I have to do for work.
Yeah, it's sort of everything that Charlie does for the first three quarters of the movie is how not to behave around somebody like this.
Right.
Because not to do.
Yeah. Not only is he jerky, he also doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And although he is a jerk, and I'm not defending him, at times he does try his best to accommodate him with food or with, you know, he buys him the TV. He goes out of his way to get him lime jello and the orange soda. Like, he's trying his best. I don't know if he's doing it because he cares for him on any capacity or if he's just trying to make it easier
on
himself.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of the growth, right? In the beginning, he's just trying to make it work for him. And then by the end, he's doing it because he cares.
Yeah. Yeah, there are more daily struggles as it goes on for Charlie because he doesn't know how to care for him.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't be able to know how to care for him. He's a self-centered, I don't know, Italian car dealer. Is that what it is?
And is there any more 80s car than a Lamborghini Countach? I mean, Jesus. And he's got like six of them.
He's trying to unload them.
And it was interesting watching this now because the reason he was having the money troubles is because the cars he was importing had carburetors, and this is when all the the emissions controls were being put into place, and they had to like spend thousands and thousands of dollars to retrofit all these cars with catalytic converters.
Yep.
And that's what was causing all the problems. I'm like, oh, that's basically, other than the clothing, that's the thing that puts this movie in a particular date and time period.
Yeah.
That, and like every other movie we do, no cell phones.
Yep. Well, that too, yeah. It's like, how much shorter would this movie have been with cell phones?
Oh, yeah. He was a stub at the payphone, and then he's farting in the payphone booth.
And whenever he gets, because he had him in the payphone booth, because whenever he would leave him alone in the car, he'd wander off.
Yep.
Yeah, he would. The fart was real, by the way. I read it.
Really?
And that was the take. They're in the phone booth. Hoffman farted. They reacted to it, and they kept it.
You know, that doesn't surprise me at all, because I mean, Hoffman is famous for the "I'm walking here" from Midnight Cowboy. It's like he just reacts in the moment because he's in character, and he just stays in character. It's great.
Do you think, and as I'm watching this, because shortly after that is really one of Charlie's biggest breakdowns. It's after the underwear and the Kmart thing and all that. Charlie stops the car in the middle of the street and has a total breakdown because this is his outburst. Like, Raymond had his in the airport. Charlie's having his in the middle of the street. I have watched this movie a lot. And my son apparently says, I say this every time it comes on. I think that Tom Cruise is better than Dustin Hoffman in this movie. Do you disagree with that?
I think he has more to play with.
I think he's so good. I think this is maybe one of his best roles. I assume he was nominated for Oscar.
So that's the thing. Like, I don't disagree. I think he's really good in this movie, possibly one of his best roles. But Hoffman won his best actor in a leading role, which surprised me because I would have pegged that role as a supporting role.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, no, I've often thought the same thing, but he won. And I when I watch this movie, I think I feel like I watch it more for Cruise than Hoffman. Hoffman certainly is great, and people remember everything he says. And yeah, I still laugh like at the things that you're supposed to laugh at when he's in the car in the 97X. Bam, the future of rock and roll, over and over and over again. It's funny. It's still funny, I think. I think that Cruise's character arc as we go through this, because for the next, I'd say the whole second act in the movie is frustrations on the road trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing, I guess, that detracts from Cruise's performance for me is that knowing, like, in a modern day, now we know what autism is to some degree. Seeing how he reacts to it is really frustrating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's like you can't expect anything else out of him, right?
No.
You just can't. And he's getting so frustrated.
Yeah, you're right. It's frustrating to watch his frustration in a 2019 sense. And that way, maybe the movie, I'm not saying that it wouldn't hold up because of that, but it does make it more difficult to watch at times. I think it also makes his character arc even more beautiful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I get right. I mean, we're getting, if you get past all that other kind of stuff and they have the bathtub scene, I think this is probably like the point where Charlie kind of really, really flips, because he understands now the hot water burn baby thing, that Rain Man was Raymond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the hugest deal, I think, in the movie, because after that he was already sort of acting differently towards him. But after that, he really does, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really powerful scene.
Now, here's my question. I kind of felt, I was trying to figure out why Raymond got sent away. And I couldn't figure out, and I don't know, did they say why he got sent away?
I don't think
I thought it was because he burned Charlie with the water.
That's what I was trying to go between that or figuring out that when the mother died, it was too much for the father to handle.
I always thought it was the water, that they thought that Raymond being around the baby was dangerous for the baby.
Maybe. Yeah.
Right. And I think I like that, even though I think your theory could work. Like that seems like a good reason. But I also feel like the fact that when Charlie learns that Raymond got sent away because he burned him, that adds a layer of guilt to Charlie.
Yeah.
He got sent away because of him. The reason that he doesn't know his brother is because of him. It wasn't his fault. He was an infant.
Right.
But it does add another layer to this very complex relationship that these two men have.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene was one take. That what you see in the movie, the two of them, the bathtub, the whole thing, that was the one and only time they did it. It's like they did it, and Levinson was like, "That's it, you got it."
Nice.
We're not even doing it. And I read that Hoffman was like, he was concerned because he didn't know how he was going to play this. And that's what he went with, and that's what we see.
Huh.
It's great.
Yeah.
And Cruz is great, too.
Yeah.
At consoling him. And they really start to have these moments together. Now, he eventually is going to take him to Vegas and try and use him.
Because he's a user.
He's a user.
Mm-hmm.
And the counting cards thing, I don't know whether or not that's a real thing. Can people do that? I don't know. Okay.
Yep.
Like a six deck shoe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't you ever see that one movie that came out of all the college students that figure out how to count the cards?
Was that the thing with Kevin Spacey?
Yes.
Yeah. I think I saw a documentary version of that story.
Yeah. I mean, it's a real thing.
Yeah. But they were actually using aids as well. Like instead of the bet one chip or two chips, they were like had little signalers in their shoes or something.
Yeah. Well, a lot of things happen for Raymond in Vegas. He's counting cards. He gets a dance lesson from his brother. Suzanne returns. He kisses Suzanne in the elevator. He drives. It's great.
It was interesting seeing these shots of Vegas in 1988 because I've spent a lot of time in Vegas for work and pleasure in the past 10 years, and it has changed tremendously.
Oh, yeah.
Since 1988. I was actually surprised to see Caesar's Palace because I thought the Strip was going to be totally different, and I think Caesar's Palace is the only thing that's still there from that time.
Yeah.
Because now it's more like family friendly and amusement park like. Is that?
Well, they tried that for a while, but I think they've gone away from that.
They're back to adult.
They're back to what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Oh.
But they've got a lot more. They're going for more modern buildings.
Yeah, I mean, because you see, there's like the Algiers and the Imperial Palace and all these. I mean, hotels that were fine for a while and then they just got torn down and replaced with something else. And so even in the past, like 5 years, there's so many different hotels there on the Strip.
I think the Flamingo's still there too.
Flamingo's still there. I mean, the damn street's named after it. I don't know what it's going to take to tear that down.
Yeah. But at some point they'll probably even decide to get rid of the Luxor.
Yeah. That thing, I don't know how, I mean, that was probably one of the first of the new Vegas things.
Uh-huh.
You know, casino hotels, and it's long in the tooth. So yeah, I don't know how much longer that's going to be around.
The scenes are iconic though. The two of them coming down the stairs with the identical suits.
Yeah.
So much so, you know, we get the hangover.
Yeah.
But these some of these shots from them at the beginning when he abducts him, them walking down that road together, that was the movie poster. These are have become movie legend kind of things, I feel like.
They're very iconic.
Yeah.
And after that, Raymond stays with Charlie at his place? Is that where they are then?
They eventually get to Charlie's apartment in Los Angeles, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I thought. I just thought he'd have a nicer apartment with all the Lamborghinis.
Oh, well, that's the thing. Because, yeah, when they get there, he's like, oh, hey, Raymond, here's your room, and oh, there's no bed. Yeah, but there will be because he has got like a sofa bed or whatever. And the rest of the apartment is like cardboard boxes and empty. Yeah. And it kind of makes sense for the kind of guy Charlie is. He's a hustler, right?
Yeah.
And he's just trying to unload a bunch of cars at a profit, and he probably doesn't spend a lot of time at home. So
nope,
that's true. That could be one of several places he owns, for all we know.
True.
Yeah.
And you have the smoke alarm scene, which I think is probably the most difficult scene to watch.
Yeah.
And there's some truth to that as well. I know that when we have a fire drill at school, I have all the, we're not supposed to know when it's fire drills, big secret, you know, big secret, but yeah. I have people, I don't think a student has died in a fire in 100 years, but we still have a fire drill every month. But I always have people texting me like, we're going to have a fire drill in 10 minutes. And I have to go around and make sure all of my students know, because the noise can be a problem. So, I mean, I appreciate that when they do that. But, yeah, there's something to that. But the main thing in all this is that the love between the brothers is growing.
Yeah.
He even takes them to that fancy pancake place with the syrup is already on the table, and he makes them laugh for the first time.
Yeah. Charlie made a joke.
Yeah. Yep. They love each other.
Well, I think the one thing, too, that to go back a little bit, when they're in Vegas and he tries to hug him.
Yeah.
And it's already kind of been established in the first with the Leon. Is that his name? Yeah. No.
Vern.
Yeah.
VRN.
My main man. That he doesn't like to be hugged or touched.
Right.
And you, just when you think things are going a certain way in Vegas, that comes back up.
Yeah, but the weird thing, the way, and I like the idea for that scene, the weird thing about the execution of it was that it seemed like when Charlie went in to hug him, it was like the most awkward.
Oh, yeah.
Like bear hug, like he's like hit him in the face with his arm, kind of like it was like you couldn't have hugged him in a worse way to get the reaction.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like a surprise, like a sneak hug. Yeah,
right.
Not good. But later on, they end up having that contact because is he a mediator? Barry Levinson in the movie playing this custody mediator. This scene is so great. It's Charlie defending his job as a brother. And at that point, I really feel like it has very little to do with the money, if anything. He just loves his brother now.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that he hands the check back.
That's true.
Yeah. So that was the thing in the first, you know, third of the movie, Charlie is greedy for the money. So he's taken Raymond so he can get his money. In the second third of the movie or more, he's greedy and he wants Raymond to stay with him because he wants to be around Raymond. And it's only in that last scene with the mediator where he realizes keeping Raymond with him is not the best thing for Raymond.
Yeah.
That's the turn. And that's really the big character moment for Tom Cruise. And he plays it really well.
He does. Yeah. He keeps asking him back and forth and Raymond can't make the distinction between the hospital and him. And Charlie's the one that ends it.
Yeah.
He says, stop. You don't need to embarrass him. Like, he is a virtuous man now.
Yeah.
And it's really great. That thing with them head to head and my main man, when he calls him his main man, that was improvised by Hoffman. He surprised Cruise with it and they went with it. The fact that they had such a good relationship and they were able to do stuff like this. I read that they rehearsed together constantly in each other's trailers all the time. In fact, when they would rehearse, they would switch roles.
Oh, wow.
So they could see what each other would have done with it, and that maybe these brothers, like we've talked about, they weren't really all that different.
Yeah.
Really, really great stories about the two of them. And that line, I like having you for my big brother, it always gets me. It's like, this, he's come full circle now, and now you love him. You hated him two hours ago.
Yeah. Right.
So great. And they get to say goodbye, and the bet two for good is just great. And the fact that you know that they'll see each other again in 2 weeks, he's going to be a part of his life. It's a great way to end it, along with getting to see the pictures that Raymond's been taking all along the trip over the credits. Great touches.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a well-deserved Oscar by all. Have I missed anything?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, it's one of the best examples of this, the thing in storytelling and movie making where by the end of the movie, the main character gets what they need, but not what they want. Right.
Right.
So the whole movie, he wanted the money to save his business. Whereas by the end of the movie, he's lost his business and he's lost basically all his money. He only won enough in Vegas to cover what he owes. So he's left with nothing but a brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's perfect. It's a perfect way to put it. I like what you said. What did you say? He gets
what he needs.
What he needs, but he wants. But not what he wants.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Who asked you on this show? Look at you.
I was at the bottom of the list.
You were never at the bottom of the list.
I love that. That should have been across the top of the poster. The story of a man who gets what he needs, but not what he wants.
Are you sure it's not?
Did you steal that off the poster? You son of a bitch.
You got me.
Well, I guess we are ready for our reviews then, and we will review this in our initial viewing versus our 2019 viewing. So, Christy, does Rain Man still hold up?
I think, I like I said, I can't remember a lot of going to see it when I was originally saw it in the theaters. I probably would have given it. It was definitely enjoyable, and I can't think of not liking it. I probably would have at the time given it about a 3. But now as an adult, I can really appreciate just how much went into it and how significant that movie is. How it not only was iconic for the performances, but it also started an awareness, which is beyond entertainment. So I probably actually would give it about a 4.5 now.
Wow.
I really enjoyed watching it again. Other than the fact that I hate his character, but I mean, you're supposed to, so it does exactly what it's supposed to do.
All right. Well, I'll go next. In 1989, I knew it was good, but it wasn't. I guess I wasn't quite ready for it yet as a 15 or 16 year old. I knew that what I was watching was excellent, but I probably didn't care as much yet because I was a teenager. So I would have given it a 3 as well. Watching it again, and I've seen this a lot, so much so that, you know, I said, like, I watch a lot of movies with my son. He's already seen this probably more than once. And I definitely think it goes up as an adult, especially because of Cruise and the direction. I lean more towards Cruise in this, and I give it a 4 now. Not only does it hold up, I think it has gotten better as I've gotten older and understood a little more about a lot of things. So, Dave, what about you?
Well, I hate to be redundant, but I think the same exact thing. Like I liked it when I saw it in the late 80s, but I couldn't appreciate it for what it really is. And now that I've grown up and learned more about relationships and about autism and about movie making in general, I would have to go from a 3 to a 4 as well.
All right. Well, in that case, this not only holds up, but it has aged well. So if you have not seen Rain Man in a while, do yourself a favor, especially if you have, you know, I other than there are some F-bombs and there are boobs.
Right? Only for just a second as she's walking with the shirt.
That's true. I think
I don't know why I was paying attention to that, but I was.
You certainly were. Apparently.
I don't know why.
I certainly was.
I know I was, too.
Little sizzling belly.
I think it's a movie you should, if you haven't seen it and you have, I don't know what age you guys think is appropriate. I'd say like 14, 15 year olds. Like, I think you should watch this movie with your family. I think it's got some lessons in it. And even if you don't agree with that, it's just a good movie with great performances. So I would recommend that you do that.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, let us know on our social media what you think about Rain Man. You can do that in a couple ways. You can go on our Facebook page, and you can also go to Twitter. We are at The Gradys. We put a lot of stuff on both, at least our episodes. And if you want to find out anything about the show or how to find back episodes and things like that, you can go to either of those. We also have a Patreon page where we accept any donations that anybody feel kind enough to give us that help keep the show running and for free. And in return for that, you also will get exclusives that we record just for our Patreon subscribers. And that's at patreon.com/NeoZaz. So next week, this conversation will continue as we count up our best five Tom Cruise movies.
There are some.
There are some. There better be five.
Yeah.
So tune in for that. And I'd like to thank Christy and especially Dave. It's been a thin slice of heaven. Thank you for coming on.
You bet.
And we'll see you next week.
Oh, well, a dim bone, dim bone, dim. Dry bones of them bones, them bones, them. Dry bones of them bones, them bones, them. Dry bones, and I hear the word of the Lord. Dry bones, and I hear the word of the Lord.